Accession number 27237, Dr. Robert Nowarski, Reel 5. We got to the point where you joined 303 Squadron at RAF Northolt in September 1940, and you were acting as an auxiliary pilot.
That's it, yes.
Now, that didn't last for long, because very early on, there was an incident. I wonder if you could tell us the story of what happened.
Yeah, well, actually, I was not an operational pilot, really. I was, as I said, just a dog's body doing this and that and the other. Mainly because I was not really experienced at all. The squadron consisted, at that time, I suppose there was a complement of at least about 25 pilots. They were all very experienced. They have flown operationally in Poland and in France. And then they came and said, I was very green. I was only, I suppose, 19 at the time. No, big one. 14. I was 19, only just 19. And I was asked to deliver a hurricane from Heston to North Weald. Actually, there are two of us. We were to deliver two hurricanes, and my friend got there, but I didn't. I didn't really quite know what happened to me. I said, I woke up in hospital, and that was that. I was then.
You don't know how you were shot down.
No, I do not know how I was shot down, or I don't even remember actually taking off or anything. That I was told later on that that's what happened. And luckily, I belly landed, which is landed with my wheels up, but in a field, not on an aerodrome. And the plane came to a full stop, hitting a sort of quite a hard hedge, and that sort of knocked me out. And that was the. I eventually woke up in hospital with my head all bandaged up, so I couldn't see a thing. I lost my sight at the time, but they told me that it's not in my left eye that was a bit bashed, and that I would certainly be all right with my right eye, and most probably with my left eye as well. And sure enough, after a few days, when they took the bandage off, I was all right. I could see that. I could see with both eyes. So it's right. It's a lovely picture of a side of a nurse of looking at me when they took the things off.
And what about your arm?
And at the same time, I broke my arm, and I had something to my knee as well. That was in plaster. Not my knee, but my arm was in plaster. That was that. I spent in the hospital.
Which hospital was it?
That was at Gravesend. But I know I was then transferred from Gravesend somewhere else. I don't remember actually where it was. I was in Gravesend only for a few days. But I don't remember actually what. I was then transferred to another hospital, and I spent there about 6 weeks or a couple of months. And after that, they sent me to Blackpool to sort of recuperate, more or less.
Was this the same place you'd been to before at Blackpool?
Oh, yes. I was in Blackpool before, yes, that's right, yes.
And did anything happen during that period at Blackpool, or was that...
Nothing very much. I do just... we are just having sort of, again... lessons in English all the time. There was no English, actually, for a foreigner like me, it was a funny language. You could after a couple of months, I could read a paper. I knew what it was about, but I couldn't pronounce it. Because nobody understood what I was saying, you see, mainly because there are so many different sort of pronunciation of different combinations of letter in English, say, like you can say mo double m double o r, I mean it's more, but you can say goose, you see. Now, why have different things for a double o? You see, I have you, goose, it's very confusing actually. For you basically have to learn it by heart, which takes time.
Now you got your back pay and you bought a car. There's some stuff.
yes. Because I wasn't then spending any money in the things. So I don't quite remember how much I had, but I had quite a bit of money paid back to me. And it was enough to buy a little car, and that was that. Second hand, of course, because people couldn't use cars in those days. They were only for essential users, like, so I suppose, nurses and doctors and police and that sort of thing, you see there. But also, you see, in the essential user thing, were pilots for some reason. So we could actually use it.
Now, so when did you leave? You went to an operational training unit.
From there, you see, they sent me to an operational training unit.
Do you know which one?
Grangemouth, that was number 61, I think. I almost said it wasn't a 61 OTU.
And when would you get there? December or?
No. Where are we now? Mid.
2 months in hospital and then.
After that, I went for a medical to make sure that I was all right, and I was pronounced that I was all right for flying duties. And after that, I went to OTU. Now, that must have been about the mid 41. It must have been about August, perhaps a bit earlier than that, May, June, or say 41, thereabouts. And then at the end of 1941, I was posted to 302 squad.
Can you tell us a bit about what were you doing at the operational training?
We were then flying Spitfires, in fact, mostly Spitfires Mark II, and it was just formation flying and attacks. How to use your guns, you see.
Tell us first about what you thought of the Spitfire, because you know we went through the Hurricane there.
That's right, yes. Well, Spitfire was a bit different to fly than a Hurricane. Hurricane was a lovely thing to fly, but Spitfire, I think it was a nicer aeroplane to fly. It required a bit more sort of care, I see, especially on takeoff, really, the Spitfire, because the undercarriage on the Spitfire was very very narrow. Now, on a Hurricane, the undercarriage was quite wide, and so the wheels came out virtually from the middle of each wing. You see, so you had quite a wide undercarriage. On the Spitfire, they were very narrow, and so that. It wasn't all that easy to maintain directional stability as you were taking off on full power. So that it was a bit tricky. You soon learned it. There was no.
What about the cockpit controls?
The cockpit layout was virtually the same. Oh yes, it was virtually the same. You had the main instruments that you had to watch. You see. And it was basically the same. There was not much difference actually between the.
What were the advantages of the Spitfire? It was a bit dodgy on taking off. I mean,
it was faster, and you're more responsive actually than when you put your foot down. It really went. You see, there. It took the hurricane just a little time to gather itself, and you could throw it about a bit, quite a bit more than a hurricane actually. It was very responsive to your controls. You actually, in a way, it was a nice aircraft to fly. And some other people might have preferred to fly a hurricane. You see, there was little to choose between them. But I preferred to specify myself. It was just a bit nicer. Not that, no, I'm not trying to denigrate the hurricane, nothing of the sort.
Now, what about this formation flying? Why was it important?
Well, that was important because you were. Taught to to fly in a certain position in relation to your to the leading aircraft, and you are supposed to stay there. You see there, and there's no when he was doing some maneuvers, you see, you had to follow him exactly. You see there, and it's quite easy to get lost in the air. You see, when you take your you're following your leader. If you're taking your eye off for out of the verge live 5 or 8 seconds or so, you may lose him altogether. You see, if he suddenly turned off and you haven't noticed it, then you're lumbered. You just don't know where he is. You see, things happen very quickly. You see, you're flying at the ordinary speeds would be, say, in excess of 250 miles an hour anyway, or 250 knots, which is about 300 miles an hour thereabouts. That that would be the normal speed to get from A to B, say, in a Spitfire. So at that speed, you see, if your leader has suddenly turned off and went down there, or whatever, you see, you would virtually lose him. So you have to keep a sharp eye and learn how to follow him, you see.
Really. How were they close? Was it close formation or
yes? You was either a close formation or loose formation. No, close formation, you see, was more for show, or think for sort of fly past that sort of thing. You see, now in operationally, you would virtually always use a loose formation.
And how what distance apart? Well,
you see, with close formation, you would be within, say, 20 yards of your leader. You see, that would be a close formation, or even less than that. Now, with loose formation, you would be something like about 50 yards away, so that he would have more space to maneuver, and so would you. You see, that would have been loose formation there, and well, you are just. Learning that.
Now you're also learning. I mean, you hadn't been taught how to fire your guns. I mean.
Well, no, you were taught how to fire the guns, but it's the you weren't really taught where to aim. You see, now if you were following, say, a Messerschmitt or whatever, and you would. Probably be at that time you would probably fly at about 350 or 400 miles an hour because you're sort of chasing the chap right now. It's no good shooting at him when he's 300-400 yards away and it's too far away. You see, you know, by the time your bullets, you see, from your machine guns get to there, you see, and well, first of all, he'll have moved another 50 yards at least, and you had to aim depending on your speed and your approaching speed to them. You had to aim so much ahead of the aircraft really, or anticipate what he's going to do. If he's going to turn left, well, you would say, if that was the aircraft, you would be aiming there somewhere. You see, there
to the left, and
yes, so there. You see, more. If it's not that, that's what he's going to do. You see, or in front. You see, so if he's going to, if he didn't see you and he was going to go straight, you see there. So it was quite a, what, when it come to, when it came to actually learning how to figure out the distances, we were shooting at drogues that were being towed by another aircraft, usually a Leisander or something, you see. Now, that it was quite clever, because the drogues were, I suppose they were about 20 meters long, and the actual size of it, you see, was, it was like a windsock, a large windsock, you see. It was quite a, it was about that wide, about a meter in diameter, so that it resembled roughly sort of the fuselage of an aircraft, you see, there. And the only trouble with it was that it was flying a bit too slow, you see, because for combat reasons, you see. Now, the Lysander would only fly at about, say, 150 or 160 knots, so you say 200 miles an hour, but the combat, you were usually at much greater speeds, you see, there. But you try to get more or less, and then find, you would then, another funny thing was that your ammunition actually was colored. The actual cases were kind of colored, you see, say, they're green or white or blue, I suppose, or red or whatever, so that they, it would make, if you hit the drogue, it would show the actual color of them, and they could they would tell you, see, now, whether you have actually hit something or whether you missed it altogether, you see. Usually about three or four pilots would be firing at the same drogue, you see, after say you would be doing it for about 10 minutes or so. You had three or four goes at it and then come back again, by which time you would have exhausted your ammunition anyway.
Now, so, but that, because it was that slower, was, it was a different deflection shooting.
Well, yes, the deflection you would have used would have been greater. But and then you knew roughly what it was. It showed you the rudiments of what it was all about.
Now, anything else you were doing at the OTU?
Well, just tactics, you see, of what to how to fly and.
What sort of thing? I mean,
information. You see, when you for information, what were your duties? Was if you were the leader, you just looked ahead and made sure that you flew fairly steadily, because the more violent, so your flying would be, the more difficult it would be for the pilots in your formation, you see. So you had to sort of learn what you can do and what you can't do. Difficult to explain, actually.
Now, the next thing then would be when you were posted to in November 1941.
Yes, end of November. Yes, I was posted to 302 Squadron. You see there, and.
Now, where were they at?
They were in Northolt.
Oh, the same place?
Yes, they were in Northolt.
A different squadron, though. It's the 303.
Oh, 303, yes, yes.
Right.
Yes,
I'm just checking
that I've
not got
it wrong. Yes, yes, no,
Now, you were flying Spitfires with these?
Yes, we were flying Spitfires, yes.
Now, could you tell, what was the squadron like? Can you describe the makeup of 302
squadron? Now, well, squadron consists. It consisted of two. Now, first of all, for flying purposes, a squadron would be 12 aircraft in a squadron. You had more than that, you see. But I mean, the 12. If you went on an operational flight, 12 aircraft would take off, and they would be divided into three sections of four. So you had. A leading four, which the squad leader would lead, and then you had say, red section on your left side of another four that would be led by a section leader, you see, and the right section, another four that would leave, say, the red leader, you see. So you would have the leader of the squadron, you see. You have red leader of one section and the blue leader or green leader of the other section, and that would be a squadron, you see. Now it's a formation of three sections of four, you see. And
now where did they come from? I mean, what was the sort of makeup of the squadron? Was it mainly Polish or was it mixed?
At that time the squadron was entirely Polish. There was no we had an English adjutant, which actually it meant that the adjutant actually was the admin chap that would be he would be looking after the administrative things, you see, and all that. But the actual squadron leader was a Pole. And the squadron had two flights, to A and B flight, you see. Now, the flight commanders were also Poles, and all the pilots were Polish.
Which flight were you in, Dad? Do you remember?
Pardon?
Which flight were you in?
Oh, Klaus, I don't remember, to be quite honest. You could be switched from one flight to another anyway, you see. Not really.
What kind of a reception did you get when you joined? I mean, how did they take you in?
They were all very... very kind and glad to see you. There's no eager to help. As soon as you started flying with the squadron, you realized that you had quite a bit more to learn yet.
Did they take you on operational flight straight away? Or
not quite straight away. No. To begin with, you had sort of training flights, sort of.
And what would you do on those?
Squadron formations. Well, the training flight would be sort of flying as a squadron would be flying in a formation. You see, because I don't know to you, you could do it, because you could not really do sort of formation flying with a whole squadron of 12 aircraft, you see. Usually it was a formation flying with two or three aircraft, you see. Now, here you had 12 aircraft flying in formation, you see. And how the sections maneuver, you see, and where were you in the formation, you see. You would have to do things a bit differently, you see, than see if you were on the other side of the formation. So it was quite a bit to learn fly in formation, you see, really in a squadron formation, and also we did quite a bit of sort of low flying as well.
Now, what was low flying like?
Well, low flying was good fun actually, because you were really flying very low, by very low. I mean, you probably over ordinary fields you wouldn't be more than 10 meters up, and it was mainly so when you, sorry, again.
Okay.
If you were being chased, you see, so when you usually went right down to the deck, you see, and tried to weave your way. So it was important to know exactly how the aircraft behaves when it's very low, or when you're flying very low, and make sure you didn't collide with any trees and things like that. You says no.
So you practiced that?
Oh yeah, you practiced that as well, yes.
Anything else you practiced before your first operational flight?
Abiban?
Anything else you practiced before the first operations?
No, that was that. And eventually, when you were... You would have done several sort of formation flying with the whole squadron, you see, and low flying as well, and high flying as well. So it was quite a bit different when you flew at, say, 25,000, 30,000 feet.
In what way?
Well, it's at that height seems to be such a large of expanse of sky in front of you, behind you, on the left or the right, you see, and even below you, you see, at that height. Isn't that, and I suppose you're more aware of the actual of the space of the things. And it was also actually drummed to you exactly so that you had to evade oxygen use. And that was actually straight away now, because once you got over, say, 12,000-13,000 feet or so, you would start feeling that you well, that was the thing, that you had to make sure that you switched your oxygen supply on at about 12,000 feet. Usually you didn't need that thing, but in case you went higher and you forgot. And some people have actually forgotten, and if you forgot, you see, it could finish up. Well, you could be dead before you wake up, really, that you, but you lose consciousness, and you don't know how. You don't know. You're not aware that you are losing consciousness. That was the main. That was the sort of sinister part of oxygen lack. You see, when you thought you were all right, but you weren't. And to drum it into you that the importance of oxygen, you would be put in a chamber, you see, say, on the ground level, you see, put in a chamber, and they would diminish the, and they would give you some tasks to do, say, ordinary sort of what arithmetic, 2 plus 2, 4 plus 4, and or write your name, or write a little passage of words, you see, on a piece of paper, and then repeat it again, and repeat it again, and repeat it again, and as they would be diminishing the amount of oxygen in the chamber where you were doing it, you thought that you were all right. You thought that everything that you were doing was perfectly all right. Until when you finished with it and came out of it and had a few breaths of fresh air, they showed you the paper what you've done, you see. And you wouldn't believe it, you see, that to begin with, the 2 plus 2 was 4, actually, yes. But at the end, the 2 plus 2 was nothing, or you couldn't even write a 2. It was a sort of funny sort of 2 that you have written, or your signature, you see, was nothing like what it was. I mean, just a scribble with a... But you, at the time when you were doing it, you were sure that this is all right. And it's it really drummed into you the importance of making sure that your oxygen is on, you see, there. And in fact, later on, for operational flights, if you did fly on operation, you put the oxygen on straight away. That was why, before you take off.
Well, we'll come, yeah.